Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 117. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, cult comedy nights. James Ross is a comedian, writer, improviser, and founder of the cult comedy club, Quantum Leopard. The club recently won a Chortle Award for Best Comedy Night in London, even though it does very little advertising beyond its own mailing list and only runs once a month. We talked about how his night operates in an underground and almost cult-like fashion, why he believes in running a gig in line with his morals is important to the circuit in London, how to build your own die-hard fan base from scratch if you're willing to put the work in, and so much more. I got loads out of this as someone who intermittently runs comedy nights and also runs a monthly one of my own. I really enjoyed sort of delving into his process and his brains, and obviously he has quite a unique personal position that allows him to run the club in the way that he wants to run it, and we get into that, and I don't want to reveal too much at this stage, and I know that isn't going to resonate completely with everyone, but it is full of information that allows you to start your own comedy night, and I found it quite inspiring, and it really sort of made me want to do more gigs and put on more shows, and so for me it was very, very motivating, and I really hope you get a lot out of this as well. I started this a little while ago in the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, link in the show notes. I started this a little while ago, and people were submitting stuff, and they kind of stopped submitting stuff. Now, that either means some of you, or most of you, have stopped creating things, or it means you have stopped learning or knowing about this project. If you start something as a result of the podcast, it can be you've made a tour, you've started a comedy night, you've crowdfunded, anything that means you've learned something from this show and you've gone away and invested time and energy into a project that helps the circuit and helps make something happen and shows that you on your own have more power in this industry than you ever thought you did, and you don't need industry necessarily, or at least you needed a bit of it, but you did a lot of it in your own. Let me know, like write it in the Facebook group, DM me on Facebook or Twitter, and let's start adding more and more of those inspiring and motivating stories to the group. I'd love to hear more of them, to be honest with you. So yeah, that's exciting. Let's get into the podcast. But before I do, if you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give it an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and as I said, it's on Facebook. Obviously, there's links in the show notes for all of that information and the places where I'm doing 32 previews up and down and around the country. If you can come to one of those, I'd massively appreciate it because gotta make some dollar. But for now, this is James Ross.
So I started Quantum Leopard because I wanted to run a lovely gig that was lovely for acts and lovely for punters.
What sounds reasonable.
I know, I felt that there were, at the time I felt there were so many gigs that didn't do anything for anybody, and kind of people didn't really know what they were for. Either acts were there and it was either acts only, like those sort of terrible open mics where, you know, everyone's just kind of waiting for their turn to go on and competitively not laughing at each other because to laugh at somebody else would be a sign of weakness, kind of thing. So, or they were circuit gigs where people were getting the shitty end of the stick and it was really, really unpleasant and a horrible atmosphere and all of this sort of stuff. So it was just to do something that, it provided a good experience for people, because I felt like I'd seen enough gigs going up and down the country that I had some sense of what was nice, what audiences wanted, what acts wanted, and it was like, how many of these boxes can I tick for people? You know, how can I remove the obstacles for people wanting to come and see a comedy show for punters, and how can I remove the obstacles for this being a pleasant experience for acts? Like, that was the basic impetus behind it.
Okay, well let's put a date on that. So how long has it been running for?
Oh, so we will have been running for about 4 years this March.
Right.
So March 2019. So we started about, I think the first gig was actually in late February 2015.
Okay.
I think. Yeah, give or take.
Okay. Without sounding cynical.
Yeah.
Would it be, because you're a product of the gigs you do.
When you say you, do you mean me specifically?
As a performer.
One
as a performer.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so the gigs that you're doing, you're noticing patterns in certain elements of them. Could it be that at the time, there were nice gigs, but you weren't particularly getting booked on them enough, or you weren't booking them, or how what were you actually, where were you gigging as well?
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
asking
sure.
your name and shame, but I'm asking, like, what's the, what, you know what I mean? What kind of vibe of the circuit were you on?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of there being nice gigs, I mean, if there were nice gigs that I didn't know about, then I didn't know about them, and people didn't hunt me down, that's fine.
Got a lot of questions from promoters. No, I'm joking. Why you book me?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was, I mean, so by that point, I think I would have been going as a solo non-character stand-up for probably about 3 or 4 years, something like that, very roughly. So like first couple of years, it's just like open mic, let's like, you know, pile them high, sell them cheap, get as much stage time in as possible. And then after that, you do your best to kind of transition to middle tens, usually in out of town gigs, and then, you know, do your best to progress to, you know, paid openers if possible, that sort of thing. My favourite gigs to do were always the sort of kind of smaller indie ones. And I was never much of like a, I'm not like a club comic in terms of my style, though, you know, I've really enjoyed doing things like, you know, Hot Water, The Stand, blah blah blah. But you know, I was never doing those at a particularly advanced level or anything like that.
Yeah, but they're quite known for allowing creativity.
Oh yeah, completely.
So they are clubs, but they are allowing people to do stuff that isn't just, you know, standing there talking about wanking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
They also, I think they definitely have comedy savvy audiences. They've got audiences that come in to see comedy, and that's what they want. It's not just like, oh, I want a non-specific night out. So they've got, yeah, I'm not in any way saying that there's like this sort of binary division between circuit gigs, which are universally terrible on the one hand, and lovely, fluffy, independent gigs, which are universally wonderful on the other. And then maybe if you've got, okay, it's definitely the case. And maybe on a third hand, you've got this undercurrent of open mic, which is its own sort of separate bucket. So that's not the sort of, it's not that simple. But I know the gigs that I generally preferred doing were ones which were, okay, I'm one person who's organizing a night, and maybe I'm a comic myself, and I just get in people that I think are good, and it's 20 to 40 people in a room above a pub, and that's really nice sort of things. And then obviously Edinburgh, run-ups to Edinburgh, blah blah blah. The gigs that I most enjoyed doing were ones where I organized them myself, like I did a front room tour of the country, and I did probably about 30-40 gigs
we'll
on the back of that.
Yeah.
Those are so much fun, because that's exactly what I want to do, because it's loads of stage time for me, which is brilliant. I get to go to interesting new places and meet interesting new people. It's a packed in, you've got density of people, they're definitely here to see what you're doing and you specifically, and yeah, it's just, and you just get to do what you want to do, and it's got an immediacy to it, which, you know, a lot of club gigs, even my lovely club gig, don't really have. So it's just super amazing. And as somebody who's, you know, really enjoy sort of, you know, independent gigs of this, that and the other stripe, it was like, okay, we're bringing comedy to it, sort of, I mean, it doesn't exactly have DIY roots, but I'm taking it in a DIY direction, so super fun. So those are the sorts of gigs that I was doing, and I don't know, I wanted to take the good elements of those and take away the bad elements of those, and I sat through so many gigs where acts or MCs would just be like laying into the front row would be having a terrible time. I spoke to so many people, just like socially, like not comedians, And they were, when I said, oh, I do comedy, so many people would have a horror story about, like, oh, I went to this club or that club or this other place. Oh, I went to the comedy once and it was just really unpleasant. They really picked on me, or I saw this happen to another audience member. I don't want that to happen to me, so I don't want to go back. I hate comedy. You know what I mean? Mm. That would be the attitude. And I was just like, it doesn't have to be like that. Like, nobody goes out wanting, I mean, I say nobody.
Yeah.
Very, very few people go out on, spend their hard-earned money to the comedy wanting to be bullied or see people being bullied. I think that's kind of unpleasant and a kind of a betrayal of the trust that you're given as a performer. And
you've never been to the Gong Show, have you?
I did it
specifically
once.
What it's for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is fine. I did the Gong Show once and unsurprisingly, I wasn't very good. And
I would imagine you were good, but it's not the format for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're very kind to say that.
No, because as someone who has got past the Gong twice, I actively tell people, look, it's a great competition and it can lead to nice things, but format wise it is not for everyone, and the layout of the night, as in the way they've structured, you know, how they put you on, is so random, and because you don't really know the acts going on necessarily and what they're going to do and how the audience are going to be by the time you get on, because the person before you might be on for 10 seconds or whatever, you know, you don't know. It's not the be all and end all as competition, even though it is a very valuable thing to be doing on the night, and it's historically something that's worth doing if you want to try that.
Absolutely,
but I just think it's worth mediating people's expectations on that, because you can be because I've seen amazing comedians die at that night,
completely.
Myself included.
I'm not saying that there is no place for Gong shows in this world, of course there is. Let's have loads of really interesting formats so there's something for everyone, that's great. But what I want to provide is an environment where we're all going to have a nice time, you know, we won't bully you for paying us money to make you laugh, you know. Of all the crimes in this world that should be punished with the kind of I'm not going to say evil, that's definitely pushing it, with the kind of treatment that some comics give a front row, I can think of so many crimes that deserve that. It's like, but giving me money is not one of them.
Well, let's start back from what you just said there. You've seen lots of good things, you've seen lots of bad things.
Yeah,
in your opinion, let's talk about the good, the bad, and the open, no,
let's just talk about the open mic.
Right, yeah.
I would watch that Western.
Yeah, that would be brilliant. That's going to be on day before tomorrow. let's talk about the good and the bad.
Okay.
On nights that you saw, how have you embraced those and rejected certain elements of it to make a night work for you?
Okay, so when I first started out, I did a sort of 25-point plan of, like, these are things that I like that I want to make happen. These are things that I don't like that I want to stop happening. And these are practical considerations that...
So for the night, not for your gigging in general?
Okay, sorry.
I thought you meant for, like, your career as a...
No. So these are things that I've seen work. These are things that I've seen not work. And this is what I want to do. In really basic practical terms, most people want to go out on a Friday or a Saturday night if they're going out. Yeah, you only get people who are really, really, really committed in a fanboyish way who want to go out Monday, Thursday, or maybe on a Sunday evening, because people want things to finish, like, vaguely on time, because if they've got, you know, work in the morning, blah, 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 it's a bit of a nuisance. So having things as well, start vaguely on time, finish vaguely on time, not overrunning, sets generally not overrunning by more than the odd minute here or there, decent length intervals so people can get a drink, have a wee, all of this sort of stuff, having chairs that it's physically comfortable to sit in, adequate toilet facilities. Granted, we didn't have that when we first started with new venues, but, you know, you add in this stuff more and more. Zone one, people generally don't want to travel that far. If you've got something that's in zone one in central London, then people can kind of travel into it, and they don't need to travel in and then back out again if you're in zone two or three. Like, if you're doing that, then you've pretty much eliminated about 2/3 of, like, the circumference of London, if you see what I mean, in terms of directions. So those are kind of, like, some of the really, really basic bits. As well, like, making things accessible is quite important to me. Like, I did stuff with the Free Fringe for many years, PBH Free Fringe. And I think it's a brilliant model that means that Edinburgh shows are accessible to punters and accessible to performers. And it takes, like, several £1,000 off your expenses. And that money goes straight into big venues' pockets. I think that's a deeply unnecessary and exploitative expense. Quantum Leopard has always been and will always be, pay what you like show. Because it means that people can genuinely pay what the show is worth. They can take a risk on something. And also, I don't think that in, you know, a a Britain that's run by the Tories, that not having loads of money should preclude you from having a really good night out at the comedy. I think that's a thing that it's a perfectly reasonable thing to ask of, you know, one of the greatest cultural cities on earth. It's like a good night out at the comedy where I'm not going to get picked on, and I get to go to it even though I'm not able to slap down 15, 20, 25 quid, whatever. Yeah. We have some people who come in and they do give us that sort of money, and that's super, super great. Love them to bits. Thank you very much. But if you come in and you don't have any money, then that's survival. That's okay. It's from each according to their ability, you know, to each according to their need. And everybody needs great comedy. So they'll get great comedy, whether they, however much they pay for it. So that's kind of it from a sort of pragmatics point of view. In terms of making things good for acts, you know, I've got, I try and pay people decently. It's always done by bucket split. And I've tried to gradually raise what I'm able to offer acts over the years, because I started 4 years ago, and gradually take like more and more kind of burdens off the performers, and like try and give them more in return. So we started out as a bringer just for the first, like, I think about a year's worth of shows, something like that. I can't remember.
So monthly bringer.
Yeah, it was monthly bringer show. Yeah. We phased that out as soon as we could.
Just because I know, like, say, I think it's about 20-25% of my audience is in London.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it is global and around the UK.
Oh, sure.
So yeah, I just keep clarifying things for anyone who isn't listening. This is about learning how what you want nights can work in cultural cities and things like that.
I mean, in the context of London, a bringer gig is a gig where you have to bring somebody along to perform. That was only for the short 5 minute spots, and then feature acts obviously who are doing 10 minute spots and longer wouldn't have to do that, but I phased that out as soon as I could. Basically, that was a way of getting audience in, building a mailing list, and as soon as we'd done that reasonably, like, I phased that out, because it's an unreasonable burden to impose on acts if you don't have to, and as soon as we didn't have to, we didn't.
So was the main list predominantly plus ones of people, or were they real people that had come along as well?
Bit of both. Also, like, the thing about Quantum Leopard is that it comes on the back of me. So I ran some kind of new material bits and pieces, like scratch nights, just for myself so I could work out new material. So I ran about half a dozen of those. So people came along to those. And like before that, like years before, like my starting point with comedy was like improv stuff, which I started doing at uni, and I moved to London and did more improv stuff here, set up my own group, won the only thing in our field to which there was an award, blah blah blah, 3 great Edinburgh runs, all of this. But having done that and run a successful night off the back of that using a slightly different model but fun thing, like, I had a significant resource of, like, significant numbers of people who would remember me running a successful gig that was fun to go to, like, a couple of years ago. So it was a bit easier to get stuff bump started. So it was a mix of those sorts of people, like friends of friends, people who were people's bringers or whatever, or and general punters, and it was a mix of all of those people. And, like, don't get me wrong, like, we're now, like, packing, like, I think we had about 95 punters in the last show. But like when we were starting out, like the first few gigs, we had like maybe 20, 30 real audience in the room kind of thing.
For indie gigs in London, just for context, that's often quite good.
Yeah.
I'm
pleased that I was able to start out with those numbers.
Yeah.
But I think, like, if you can start with that sort of momentum, like, it's much easier to get somebody to come back to your gig than it is to get new people every single time.
Yeah.
So if you ensure that they have a decent time, you put on a lovely night, that they're well treated, all of this sort of stuff, then they'll come back. And we have people that are still coming to the show who came to like the second ever gig, and that they're still coming because we put on a really good night.
So when you're advertising at the very start, is it come to the loveliest comedy? Like, what made your advertising different that made people want to come to yours? I mean, I assume it was still a Saturday. Was it Saturday?
Oh, yeah, still a Saturday.
So it's always a Saturday. Fine. So that helps, because people are out and they haven't got work the next day. And
Exactly. Yeah. So it was very much like, let's frame it as a lovely, fluffy, progressive gig. Like, there's various other things which I haven't mentioned, because I was going to talk a little bit more about the other things that I was trying to do to make it decent for acts and also decent for punters, but that sort of shades into this a little bit.
Okay.
You know, a marketing USP or whatever. Like, it was very much a let's have a lovely, fluffy gig where you're not going to get picked on, where that's, you know, a core part of what we do, where there's no heckling. It's not like a bear pit kind of confrontational atmosphere. It's just, let's have a lovely, fun, indie, DIY type gig in, like, I mean, our first two venues were both rehearsal rooms. So we got them dead cheap because no one wants to rehearse on a Saturday night and it's dead time, dead space for the venue. So they may as well let us use them for Tup and Tapeny. So that works out quite well. But, you know, we didn't have a mic for many years. Like, we've only just got a mic.
And I don't want to interrupt you, but when I did it without the mic, I'm not going to say I love performing without a mic, by the way, because I'm not saying that. But the ethos of the night and the way it felt in the room and the fact that the audience kind of, you know, like you said, a lot of them have returned, so they kind of knew it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't feel like it was weird.
Nah.
At least I didn't. I'm sure other performers... No, because other performers who, like, need the mic. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But often I do. If I go into a venue and they're like, we don't have a mic, I'm sort of like, oh, okay. Yeah. But with yours, I just was like, okay, cool, then I will just... Talk like I normally do.
Talk louder. Yeah.
I'll be a bit Jesus-y and be like, hello, guys. But we're dick jokes.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine. But, I mean, it does mean you do have to project a bit more. And, like, to be fair, like, that's something that comes to me, I say naturally, but, like, because I've been doing improv stuff for years, like, I've been used to playing completely unamplified to audiences of several hundred people. So that's, like, manageable. So, yeah, that's kind of, and again, that kind of fed into the sort of the DIY ethos and feel of the thing. So that was kind of what we were doing. Yeah, I mean, like, the other thing that I was kind of sick of is, like, all male lineups, because it's boring. And so, like, nowadays it's always 50-50 gender split. At minimum, it's 50-50 gender split before when I book the gig and finalise the lineup. Then I end up with, like, dropouts, last minute, all of this sort of stuff, blah, blah. But it starts out as being, like, 50-50 more or less. Mm. Often 60-40 in one direction. But if you take a couple of months worth of gigs, it'll average out and it's, like, it's even. When we were starting out, I didn't really have enough contacts to do that. And it was like, okay, I need to make sure that I have at least two women on the bill. So we've not got one woman who's the lone woman. And then I gradually built that up over time. More women, blah, 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 all of this sort of stuff. Mm. In terms of other stuff that's kind of good for acts, like, I'm really transparent about progression. Like, if you are an act who's on your way up and you're going out and you're doing slots, like trial spots for people, and you're going out and you're doing open unpaid tens in various places, like, you might have a chat with the promoter, you might not, you might get some feedback, you might not. With us, 100% transparency. Like, you come in, you do a 5-minute spot, you will, at the end of the night, now you will get a paid fiver. You wouldn't once upon a time, but, like, I started paying everybody as soon as I could afford to pay everybody. Pay a fiver for your, like, bus fare, pint, whatever. And there's then an audience vote on the act that they want to see come back and do a paid 10 at a future one.
And that obviously helps them want to come back as well, because exactly. They're like, oh, I might come see them.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You get a preview, and, like, for an audience, like, you've got then a sense of agency. And, like, we've got loads of acts now that's the main route into the gig now, and I can now book, like, a really good bill solely from Quantum Leopard competition winners over the last 4 years, including, like, major award nominees, national award winners, all of this sort of stuff. Like, that is a thing that I can do because I've been running this well enough for long enough, and because, like, it's a nice enough gig that people want to come back to it, and people, like, good people who are, like, semi-pros at that sort of level will come in and do a 5-spot for me and, like, smash it out of the water, and, like, my audience will love them and they'll go, yes, we like you, come back for a 10. And that will, like, start that's what genuine progression looks like when it's got a degree of transparency to it. So, well, there's that aspect.
And when you, so I'm just sitting there working out numbers, when you think about that, because you know 4 years approximately, that means you've done less than 50 of these.
It's a bit more. Like, we moved from monthly to once every 3 weeks. I can't remember exactly when we did that.
Yeah,
I think we've got now probably about just shy of 60 competition winners.
Yeah.
So
even if you said you've done 60 of them in 4 years,
yeah,
it's not that long that it's been, you know, going for and that it's been building, and so it's quite. So I mean, it's in a positive way. It's quite impressive that you know, when you, because I was talking to someone I'm not going to mention the word, but I was talking to someone at a gig the other day, and they were like, oh, it just looks like so much work to get a gig going, and I went, it is, but it's the getting through the first 6-8 months of.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's same with podcasts. Yeah. Once you're through the first 2 years or year and a half of it or whatever, you know, people just sort of know it's around.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of that weird thing.
Quantum Leopard is an overnight success that, like, that was a real struggle to get off the ground for the first year minimum. And again, it's the sort of overnight success. Like, I've been running comedy stuff in London on and off for 10 years. So even its initial bump start success, in inverted commas, like, that came on the back of a solid 4-5 years worth of like running stuff, even if it was just like my own scratch nights, if it was booking my own touring, things like that, all of this sort of stuff. So yeah, it's one of these things where it's like, keep plugging away at it, build it up gradually, and like make sure that you kind of keep the contacts that you've made, and that's the way that you will run a better and better night over time.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, this might be a redundant question just because it feels like it would be the opposite of what you've said. But you, also, what were the negatives you'd seen around that you were
able to
avoid?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I mean, that kind of brings me on to some of the other things that, like, again, good for acts, good for punters. I mean, I touched on this earlier, but, like, acts having a go at punters from the stage when they've done nothing to warrant that whatsoever. It's just like, it's not nice. Like, it's rude. We raised in a barn. What's wrong with you? So, you know, kind of like, we started off with like, okay, like no audience interaction, unless you, I forget exactly how we phased it, but it was basically like minimal audience interaction. Then we went to, okay, if you need a volunteer for this, then we'll get you one in advance. And like for the last year or so, we've been operating a system that's worked really well, and acts seem to really like it, and punters seem to really like it, which is basically like, if you're doing sort of general call and response with the audience, that's totally fine. But if you're doing sort of crowd work, or you want something that needs a volunteer for whatever reason, then you can only do that with people who are sat in the front row who are wearing a green sticker. And the green sticker is really easy to see. And the green sticker means that they have actively consented to having a chat. You know what I mean? And I will have a chat with the front row at the beginning of the gig, and some people will want a sticker and some people won't want a sticker. And that's totally fine. We've got a well up for it front row, but some of them want to be well up for it by laughing nicely rather than being dragged up on stage. And even if you do drag somebody up on stage, like, just be nice to them. Don't do the sort of audience interaction, audience volunteering in inverted commas, which is, I'm going to get you up on stage and get you to dance humiliatingly for 3 long minutes. And that's the point of the joke. I'm not going to do anything here. It's just your discomfort that is... That's the humour in inverted commas here, and that's it.
You've seen Barry's up. No joke.
I've seen at least half a dozen people do that over the years.
Really?
Really? And like genuinely, we're looking at those sorts of numbers, and it pecks my fucking head every time it happens because it's so lazy. It's so lazy, and it's just like, it's getting an audience member to do your work for you, and it's not even that you're getting them to be funny for you. It's literally victimising them to get some awkward, nervous laughter out of the rest of the audience. And like, that's not, like, that is David Koresh level of crowd work. I don't want that. Yeah, that is not good.
Yeah, the laugh's coming more from the fact that relief, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
well, the only two that come to mind, and I'm asking you to name them, but the only two that come to mind are obviously Nina Conti, who brings people up and kind of gets them to do, you know, like with the sort of, but I mean it's ventriloquism stuff, so it's kind of like getting them to say something that's a bit dodgy that they wouldn't necessarily say, or dance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I feel like when you go and see her at her shows, you kind of know that might be a thing that you get asked to do. And obviously maybe like a compilation show, you're not aware of her work, and then it's a bit harder for her to do.
Yeah.
But anyway, and the other one's Tapeface, obviously, who brings people up and does sort of odd things to them and, you know, plays things around. But I've never, I mean, maybe it's just the gigs I'm doing, or maybe it's changed from when you've seen those people.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were hyperboling it for effect. And for me, the idea of someone using an audience member for them being the punchline, and they haven't done anything wrong, you know, they haven't like heckled you, or they haven't literally said, I could do that, you know, like that
sort of
thing.
Yeah.
That just seems...
I don't want to name names.
No, of course.
I like some of the people personally. I'm just like, that's not how I want to see comedy.
Even if you didn't, like, I would mute it out on this.
Yeah.
Because this isn't a gossip thing. And that's why I'm happy to name those two, because it's a positive version of that.
The thing is to mention as well is that both of those two people, like Nina Conti and Tapeface, are both like staggeringly fucking good at what they do. They're the absolute top of their game.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are absolute masters of their craft. A lot of the people that are doing it on the way up are like, here's a cheap, lazy laugh. In the same way that, like, lazy shock humour, that will get you a laugh. That'll get you a laugh once. You know what I mean? But, like, diminishing returns to scale, all of this.
Yeah, of course.
Like, it's something that you do because you're aware that it gets a reaction. But if you keep doing it, it gets, like, more and more alienating and unpleasant over time. And it's just, it's something that you need to be careful with. Like, I mean, in terms of, like, topics that you can cover as a stand-up, I think you can cover anything. But, you've got to cover it cleverly and well. You've got to be like, there's some topics where it's like, okay, if you're covering this, then you need to be staggeringly careful about this. You know what I mean? It's like handling like uranium rods. You know what I mean? There's nothing inherently wrong about uranium rods. It entirely depends on what you're using them for. You know what I mean? Like, it's like this is dangerous when handled improperly.
Yes, yeah.
So you've got to owe like the basic level of respect to your material, to your audience, to the wider world that you exist in as, you know, a citizen and human being, to like treat that stuff with respect. And I think that's really important. And that kind of leads me a little bit on to like the content policy.
Yeah, the content policy is next
to me. I mean, this is obviously the big thing that's going to like trigger the right wing snowflakes, because, you know, they're enormously fragile. The very idea.
Are they allowed to be? See, that's the thing. Always label. Like, I thought we're. So I'm a lefty. So I was like, I thought we're snowflakes, and they're what, grammar Nazi? Well, they have a whole different.
Fucking fascists is what they are.
Like, no. But like, I don't like any of the name calling evil side.
Well,
do you know what I mean? It just doesn't. I think it breaks down. I mean, we're not going to.
I mention it only just because like the whole snowflake thing is just ridiculous. When you see that, like, oh, we're complaining about fragility, blah blah blah. Like, these are people who are triggered by the existence of a vegan sausage roll or a Gillette advert that suggests that maybe bullying people maybe isn't that great, and they just go fucking off on one.
I had a friend of mine who's very left as well the other day, because she was saying that men are getting uptight about, you know, the shaving ad and all this sort of stuff, and I said to her, there are some men who are having a debate about this, and this is just to do with what we're talking about, triggering and stuff. I think you can't possibly know everyone's back history with certain topics and so even if it is small to you, if it's triggering to someone else, you're going to have to respect that, even if it isn't something that you can empathize with and you don't understand. Yeah. So if the advert is triggering you, I'll listen to your point. But if your point's stupid, I'm going to, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
if your point is something like, you know, I don't like the way that you know, there were a few men who were like, we're talking about an advert now, but they were talking about, you know, how it was cynical of an, and I even posted about this. And I agree with that point. I'm like, yes, totally cynical of them after they've, you know, had women with the Gillette thing on, like, hot pants and things to then come out with this.
But now, at this time, why now? The answer to that is to abolish capitalism. That's the answer, Simon.
But then what if you got? Then what have you got? Because in the current situation, what do you change that with? What do you replace it with?
In all seriousness, though, like, I mean, obviously, there's this enormous hypocrisy about these adverts. This is clearly being done for profit as a way
of
co-opting social movements, blah, blah, blah. But I think one of the interesting things about it is that somebody at Procter & Gamble has looked at a spreadsheet and gone like, okay, we can appeal to dickheads here, or we can appeal to people who think that bullying is bad. And okay, it makes more business sense for us to try and appeal to people who think that bullying is bad. And I think that's a really good sign. Yeah. So one of the things that capitalism does reasonably well is allocate resources in ways that are like are optimally, in inverted commas, like satisfying market desires, like consumer desire.
Completely.
Like, yeah. Okay. So
what I'm going to do though is we can talk about this.
That's like, fine.
Let's talk about your content policy.
All right, okay, content policy.
You can reel it off because I'll forget it. Sure. What is the content policy?
So the content policy basically is like, no racism, sexism, homophobia, no transphobia, no like chav bashing, like, you know, classist bullshit. No ableism and whorephobia, I think, was on the list.
Okay.
No rape as a punchline, and no picking on the audience. Which is like, I've done that in one long sentence. You know what I mean? Like, I can do that in a single breath.
I know, so I'm getting you to do it, not me.
Yeah, it's fine. Well, I've got greater lung capacity than you, Simon. Honestly, if you can't get through that in a single breath,
no.
then like you're really serious. Get your lungs seen.
My worry was forgetting some of it, and then you calling me out and going, you forgot the main bit. Racism. And then like someone going, oh, Simon said racism was fine. Yeah. You forgot it on the list.
It's fine. I mean, like, it's one of these things. Like, it's just, like, I mean, it's basically like, don't be a bellend. But like, I can't put it as don't be a bellend, because people always ask me about that, and it does need unpacking.
But like, the other problem you've got is that people interpret their jokes, you know what I mean, like they could say, I don't think this is racist,
exactly,
or I don't think this is, so in the nicest way possible, you are sort of putting yourself in a moral arbiter position where you go, I'm not going to say it.
Go on, say devil's advocate, Simon. Don't use the word devil's advocate.
Do you know why I don't want to do it? Because
you know my views on that phrase
and practice. Have I told you? Because I don't think he needs my help.
I don't think the devil needs my fucking phrase.
I don't think we've had this discussion.
My phrase has been the devil has quite enough advocates in the world already.
I just literally say he doesn't need my help. He seems to be getting on fine.
Yep.
So we've got a slightly different, but the same.
All right, fine. All right, same page.
No, I always stop myself because I feel I don't mind. This is hypocritical.
Yeah.
I don't mind any other group, like so women or people of color, any of that saying it. But I just feel like as a white man, you saying it means you're going, I'm not going to stand behind my shitty view. I'm not going to stand behind my crappy opinion or question. I'm going to say the devil and it's my thing. So I'm not going to say it, even though you dared me.
That's fine.
But what I will say is by putting yourself in that position as a white man, and as a sort of privileged man.
I'm spectacularly white. So that's not in dispute here.
So my question would be, how do you balance your way of interpreting a joke for your night versus how, say, for example, someone came and did a joke that you thought was an ism for whatever reason, but it got a good reaction and nobody complained. You didn't get a single complaint.
If it gets a good reaction and there's not a single complaint, and I promise you, my punters, particularly my regulars, are not shy of complaining if they feel that something's a bit too, if they're not happy with something, then I'll let it slide. You know what I mean? Like, this thing, like, I do my best, and it's one of those things. Like, I'm never going to get it perfect because, like, it's a human process.
Yeah.
But just because you can't have a perfectly sterile environment doesn't mean that you shouldn't conduct surgery in a sewer. Like, give it a go. Do your best. Like, the low-hanging fruit is really obvious. Then you can go for stuff on slightly higher branches. Just try. That's all I'm asking.
Do you tell comedians then? Do you go, we've had these complaints?
It varies. Part of it is, like, I just don't have that problem, really, because the kind of acts who want to do the gig are generally not people who would really fall afoul of that anyway. Like, I'm not saying that, like, absolutely every act has to be, like, ultra PC, super right on. That's not what the gig is about. It's just about, like, here's, like, things that are just obviously stupid. Like, here's the obviously low-hanging fruit of... I never want to use the word... Like, I like the phrase political correctness because it acknowledges that, A, this is a political question, and B, that it is correct. Those are the two things I like about that phrase. What I dislike about it is that it distracts us from what it really means, which is like basic fucking manners and respect. And if you insert the phrase basic fucking manners and respect into conversation where the words political correctness are previously, then you find a lot more sentences make a lot more sense. So that's what I'm trying to enforce, and that's what I want in my gig. I want my acts to, you know, have that basic degree of respect for my punters, for the subject matter that they're dealing with, for like the issues that they're discussing, for the groups and the people, because those are real things to real people, and a lot of those real people are in my audience, and they've been put off going to a lot of other clubs because like they see that being discussed in a really ham-fisted and stupid way, and I don't want that. My punters don't want that. Part of our USP as the night is you're not going to have that problem here, and if you do, it'll be very brief and off it goes. So like I say, like some of the sifting is like self-selecting people who want to do my gig in the first place. Anybody who's going to be put off by that doesn't express interest in doing the gig. When I'm doing the 5 minutes, I sift those. They all apply by email. They send me a video clip. I ask for written agreement to the ethos just to confirm that they've read it. If they don't confirm that they're fine with that, then I don't book them. Or at minimum, if I really like the video, I'll go like, I love the video. Can you confirm that you agree with the ethos? And if they do, then great. And I'll get them in. But just to confirm, like, you are aware of what's going on here. You can't plead ignorance. And so that's one stage of sifting. I reject sort of 4 or 5 applications for every one I accept because the gig's in really, really high demand. And so I do get to be a bit picky. So if I think somebody is a bit too close to the knuckle in an annoying way that I don't think is productive or interesting, then I'm like, I'm just not going to book you in the first place. So that's part of it. In terms of feature acts, like I can count on one hand the number of times I've had a problem. I've generally had a chat with the acts about it, either immediately or some stage later on when they've made inquiries about coming back. And we've usually had a pretty productive conversation about it because, like, professional comedians who know what they're doing, respect their craft and have enough confidence in themselves, take that sort of constructive feedback on board. If you're called out on something, and I deliberately use the phrase called out because I know that's going to, you know, trigger the fashtards.
I knew you did.
Yeah. you've got two options there. And like, this has happened to me enough. And like, I'm no angel on this. Like, I've made the wrong call and had the wrong reaction on a number of occasions. Like, I'm hold my hands up to that. You've got two choices. Either you think about your material, and think about the ways in which it's affecting the person that has raised this issue with you, and you go back to your joke and you think about it and you think, how can I approach this better? How can I improve this joke? How can I add context to it that means that it's better situated in the world which it lives in? Like, how can I do that? And on no occasion have I ever not gone back to a joke of my own and done that and made it worse. Every single time I've had to do that, I've gone back, I've thought about it more, and I've made it better. And I thank the people that I've responded to, people who've made those inquiries with me, like, good, you're helping me improve as a performer. On a handful of occasions, I've got it wrong, I've made the wrong call, and like, I've not responded as well as I might, because like, I'm, you know, I'm lovely, I'm fluffy, I'm a leftist, blah blah blah, but I'm also a comedian, therefore like, largely driven by ego and caffeine. So anyway, but your other option is to do like, basically go the Louis C.K. route and like, double down on it. I've been called on this bullshit, and so I'm just going to double down on it. Like, I've been called on this thing. Either I can admit I'm wrong and change, or I can go down the route of saying that this thing was right. And I will reinforce that. And that is the route I will now take. And I think that is a bad decision. I think that's a bad decision morally. I think it's a bad decision in terms of like, your direction as a performer. I think it's the wrong choice, and it's not the choice that I want to encourage. But good, solid professional performers, people that I like, the kind of people who do my gig, the kind of people who are confident enough, they're willing to take that sort of feedback on board, like, they respond well to it, they respond constructively to it, and I book them again. Like, that's how that works.
I completely agree with you, by the way.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
the thing you brought up with the CK thing is,
yeah,
I don't know how much you want to discuss this with, like, what, like, on tape, if you like, but yeah. My frustration with all of this, as in what's happening at the moment in that area,
yeah,
not just with him, just in general, is I can only think of one, I think, comedian who has handled an apology like well, and I can't even remember who it was a writer on a TV show who apologized on his podcast,
yeah,
to a woman from his staff. I cannot remember names, and I'm not trying not to name them. I just can't remember now. I can Google it and I'll put it in the show notes. It'll be in the show notes. I'll highlight it. There's a part of me that the doubling down thing, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Because for me, whenever I've had a discussion, so you've seen my pancakes for equality joke, for example, the one I did at your November night. And I even said to you before I went up, is this going to be okay? Because I panicked for a minute and I hadn't done it for a while. And I was worried I would get words wrong because wording in that joke is really important.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said, no, you'll be fine. You'll be absolutely fine. And I remember thinking to myself, if someone had a problem, because I've had one person have a problem with that joke, and it didn't change any of the joke, because essentially when I spoke to them, they had been a bit drunk and hadn't listened to the opening bit of the joke.
Yeah.
And if you miss the bit where I make it clear where I stand on it before I rip it apart, you know, it ends badly.
Context is important.
Yeah. But the thing is that in that situation, I, being a very insecure person, really wanted to make sure they knew that I wasn't an arsehole.
Yeah.
But there's no way of doing that because I can't wait until the next day to text her and go, I was trying to be, like, you know, because they're drunk, they're just, you know, I'm not gonna wait for them to sober up and get home from Brighton, you know.
So there's
this whole thing about that person will have that story from me, and there's no way of me redeeming myself, even though I've done that joke around the country and nobody else has had a problem with it, and it's not, I'm not blaming them for that, but it is more on them that they didn't hear that part. And so there's this whole, you know, would you ever reconsider an act who you'd seen do something, you've had a not a bad altercation necessarily, but like, they haven't changed the material, but they've gone, I'll just come and do a different joke then. Would that, what would that lend for you? And it might be a hypothetical at this point, but I'm wondering,
it's an entirely hypothetical where
you land on redemption for acts who maybe have said something that you know breaks your policy.
I mean, what I would do with acts that are like that but who I like, you know, there's not a complete overlap with acts that adhere to the content policy and comedy that I enjoy. Like, that Venn diagram is not a circle.
No.
Like, I'd watch them again. I would try and watch them in another context. And if I liked them, I'd get them back in. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, just going back to that point you were making there about this audience member who kind of went off and has this story. Mm. At the end of the day, like, I think, so I had this realization a while ago, this is in the context of like personal relationships. And this is in with regard to like one specific former partner of mine. And I kind of came to this realization. This is somebody who I had a relationship with of non-negligible length. And we parted ways, and there was a bit of kind of back and forth as to like, you know, is this a good ending for a relationship? Is it a bad ending for a relationship? And then it kind of pieced out a little bit, blah, blah, blah. But I kind of came to the realization that wanting to maintain a friendship with former partners, that's a thing that I needed for my self-image as like a nice guy, again, to use a phrase that's got connotations that I don't necessarily want, but like somebody who is basically decent. But I don't have the right to expect that from somebody else. Mm. And I don't have the right to push that on somebody if that's not what they want. Ultimately, like they've had exactly 50% of that two-person relationship. And what they want to do with it in terms of their memories, how they want to think about it, is entirely up to them.
Yeah.
Provided they're not literally libeling me, I have no claim on them. I have no claim on what they're doing, how they think about it, how they feel about it, whatsoever. So doing the whole, like, you know, let's all meet up in the year 2000 thing, like that's selfish. And in the same way that, like, needing to scramble back for the good opinion of people that have seen you on stage and maybe not quite liked you as much or thought of you in the way that you want them to, scrambling for their opinion is selfish. They don't owe you anything. They don't owe you that time. No. It's up to them to, like, feel how they feel about that.
Yeah.
And it's up to you as, like, a nominally confident person who exists in the world. Just bear that with fortitude and just go on with your fucking life. And that's what I've done in the context of that relationship. That's what I've done with every, like, bad gig, blah, 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 where I've had that sort of similar kind of experience to you there. Yeah. Not that I, you know, have that experience often, but, like, in comparable situations.
Yeah.
You've got to draw a line under it at a certain point for your own sanity and learn what you can from the experience. Try and become a better person, try and become a better performer, and go forward with that.
Well, that altercation happened in 2015.
Yeah.
And I remember when I finished, I did the DVD record of that show.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to myself, every preview, every Edinburgh show, all of that, like, that's the line. You know what I mean? I won't.
Yeah.
But it's hard as a human not to, you know, reminisce and think about stuff like that sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's not, and it doesn't bug me. It doesn't have a problem. But I was bringing it up because...
You say it doesn't bug you, but you are bringing up an anecdote from 2015.
But can I tell you why, though?
Okay, go on.
Because there's a specific reason.
All right.
Because I feel like whether you...
Was that person me? Was it me? Was I wasting your show in 2015?
You were, yeah. Do you not remember?
Oh, I don't remember at all.
I brought this up completely. Okay. Well, you don't remember much of 2015, to be fair.
If you can remember 2015, then you weren't there.
Yeah. No, my reason for bringing it up,
right,
which, by the way, I've ham-handedly brought it up from my notes, but the reason I'm bringing it up is whether you're doing it consciously or not, and that was part of the question, if you are doing this consciously or not, is I was outside... It was November the last time I did your one. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting outside with another act, just chatting away for, you know, you're doing your bucket speech or whatever it was at the end. And as people were leaving, I asked the act if we could talk in a sec. Because what I wanted to do was just listen to people leaving.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to hear what they were talking about. And, you know, maybe shamelessly, maybe hearing them say, I was very good.
But that wonderful Simon Kane, he's very talented, not so conventionally attractive. I'd like to have his furry face pressed up against my inner thighs.
Let's start with, it's definitely conventionally attractive. let's not lie to me, but funny, yes, hilarious, definitely.
You're welcome, go on.
I did love how you liked that post on my face. Oh, sorry, I had a conversation with someone the other day where they said, oh, you're not going to put me in your comedy, are you? And I was like, look, be more fucking funny.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll think about it. I'm not a miracle worker.
You do yourself a disservice, Simon. I think that you could very definitely be considered conventionally attractive. It just depends on the convention. If it's for, like, I'm looking at your appearance now, and this is obviously a visual joke on a podcast, if it's a convention for lumber Jews, then fucking bang on.
That's got to be a title for a show at some point.
Simon Kane, lumber Jews.
I'm not a lumberjack or a Jew, so it's definitely going to be fun. No.
Oh, fair enough. No, I like to point that I am a bit, which means I can say that. I genuinely thought you were Jewish.
No. I thought I was a lumberjack. So
no! God, no. No, not with your upper arms.
My parents are Jewish, but I don't believe in God. So I suppose culturally at best.
Yeah.
But I find it annoying when people do that, because it's a bit like denying my choice of what I believe in.
With you now. Okay,
and, so I don't mind when people go, oh, you're culturally Jewish, too much. Yeah, but when they do it too much, I sort of go, oh, okay, fine. Well, I'm just going to ask you where, you know, your ancestors are from, and I'll just start saying you're culturally wherever that is.
It's one of those things where, like, if it keeps getting mentioned too often, you're like, what's going on with this? Like, yeah. I remember having one very weird date where, she was really, really weirdly fixated on the fact that I was a quarter Jewish and just kept bringing it up. Yeah. Like, you don't need to mention it this much. Like, what's...
She probably had a fetish or something.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Because I've only just found out that, because I've got friends of mine who are Jewish.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm saying that, like, I've got friends though. no, but I've got friends who are Jewish. And like, one of my friends told me recently that he was going out with this girl and she made it quite clear that her big fetish is Jewish people. I've never heard of that kink before.
Takes
and
sorts.
I've heard a lot of kinks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, genuinely. Like, I had a few people who've, across whose radar I have come, which is...
I was wondering how you're going to end that, and I thought you were just going to say jizz, but fair enough, you've got more class than me.
I kept it PG. Yeah. As plausible deniability when it came to that, innuendo. It's a thing. Like, you know, you've got... I have a certain look. I have, like, you know, brown curly
quarter
hair.
Quarter Jew, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Brown curly hair, fleshy snowplow of a nose. Like, I get both of those features from that part of my family. Yeah, I mean, I look like that.
I just think it's fine for you to acknowledge I have a cultural history.
Oh, yeah,
that's
fine.
But it's just when people bang on about it.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's like, you know what? If we're all trying to live in a society, I mean, we're not up to a certain point. I mean, I wish we were, but I would like to think we're living in a place where, you know, if you tell me that you've got a pronoun, I should be able to say, I don't believe in a God. Stop telling me I'm Jewish.
I mean, I suppose part of it is, like, you know, the age old thing of, like, okay, is Jewishness, like, okay, is this an ethnic designation or is this a religious one? And I know loads of secular Jews who would say one thing and loads of religious Jews who would say another. And
yeah, it depends. But my point was, I was listening to people leave, and I'm going to call them the story because I was only overhearing bits of it.
Uh-huh.
But the story people take away from your night is fundamentally what you're saying now. Mm-hmm. You know, lovely night, great acts. Oh, that was funny. Great time. Don't get that in X Club was what one person said, you know, it's like, you know, in a good way.
In a good way.
Sorry, not just like, oh, I'm talking about that bollocks. That you know what I mean? But my point was, because I've been to your night as a person to watch and as an act. And so I'm aware of what it's like. But for someone who hasn't been, and for someone maybe wanting to start their own night, lovely night in another city, maybe where they're not going to compete with you. Like,
I'm fine. I want more people to copy bits of Quantum Leopard.
Yeah.
And like, I've not got a trademark on anything Quantum Leopard, like,
well, maybe the logo.
Elements of the... obviously the logo and the name, blah, blah, blah. But like, 100%.
Please tell me you have copyright Quantum Leopard.
Say again?
Have you got the name Quantum Leopard copyright?
I think I might have it licensed under Creative Commons or something. That's but amazing. Like, blah, blah, blah. Like, basically, if somebody is listening to this and they want some advice on, like, how to set up a lovely, fluffy night in wherever it is they are, like, get in touch. Like, I want comedy to be better because I want to be able to go to more comedy nights. I want there to be more comedy fans out there whose expectation is I'm going to a lovely, fluffy comedy night where I'm not going to get picked on and I'm going to have a nice time. I want more of that. Like, look me up on Facebook.
I'll put your Facebook and your email and stuff.
Put my email up on it. Okay,
cool.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, cool. So, subject line, Simon's amazing podcast interview.
Subject line, Simon Kane, Lumberjew.
We'll go with that.
And I'll put a special filter so it'll go straight to my advice pile.
That'll be fine. We'll do that. But if you don't use the hashtag Lumberjew... He's going to ignore it.
Work. But yeah, like, in all seriousness, like, I would love people to, like, take elements from my night and use them in their own. I get so many, I get, like, people saying, I really like this thing, can I use it? I'm like, 100% yes.
Yeah.
I want you to do that. I want to lead this by example.
Well, I mean, I'm going to talk about some of the things from your night.
Sure, yeah.
That I think are making people leave with that story.
Uh-huh, cool.
Okay,
yeah.
So you've got badges.
Oh yeah, badges. Yeah,
let's start
badges.
Because I run a night and we are starting to implement badges.
Badges. There we go.
And it's slightly different system for yours because we have the rainbow sort of thing about LGBT. So we're going to try and do a different colour for each.
Oh, cool.
You know, so like, the more you come, the more rainbow badge you get.
Ooh,
so it's going to be a
multi-level
fun
marketing.
I know.
Like, it's going to be right.
No, because we have other ones that are a bit more kinky, should we say, badges for the people who maybe want a bit of a risque badge that they can't wear at work.
Gotcha.
Go on. So
there's no backing, you just stick the pin straight into
So what's your badge system?
Cool.
And
so
why does it exist?
So it was basically me thinking about, like, okay, how can I make the comedy night more of an experience? How can I make this more of a community thing? How can I make people want to come back more? Mm. A part of that is like, you know, you'll come for the sunshine, you'll stay for the people. Mm. And so that's like, okay, what can I find a way of giving people like more of an incentive to think of themselves as an in-group, as like people who are regulars, and this is a thing that we do, and also a little bit like a thing that we are. Like, that makes me sound like the Borg, but like, that's kind of, you know, yep. I mean, look, the Borg have a significant degree of collective solidarity, you know, the kind of planned economy I'd really like. Yep. So I'm broadly in favour. I think the Borg get a bad rep in Star Trek. We'll move on. So
remember, we are limited for time. The cleaner wants us out.
That's fine. So the badges are basically, if you come to 10 Quantum Leopards, or you bring 6 people along to a single Quantum Leopard, then you get a Quantum Leopard badge. And the first one of these, limited edition, there's only 100 ever made. We're now onto the second edition badges that have got a new logo. And if you get that, then it means that you get priority booking for the mailing list. So you get the email for tickets about 3 hours earlier than the rest of the mailing list in general, which means if you want a ticket and you know when to wait, and you always do, then you will get a ticket. It means that we've got a little WhatsApp group as well, so you can have a chat with us about general comedy bits and pieces. You get to choose a song for the Quantum Leopard playlist. Occasionally I ask people's opinion when I want to talk about people who are like a bit invested in the gig, and then I will ask that group, that sort of thing. So it's just generally a sort of a, like, it's a bit of a thank you for people coming to the gig. And like, they're like, I spent a non-negligible amount of money on the badges. Like, it's a, you know, it's a fairly swish thing. Like, you know, for
they're enamel stuff.
Yeah. And like, you know, spare no expense. It's like, it's the largest size that you can get that the badge company does, and they're full color. And like, it's a genuinely, it's a fancy thing that people would actively want and would wear on their lapel if they're like, if you're a badges type person, you would like this badge. So it's something that has like objective merit and value as well as a bit of a thank you for people coming out and supporting it. So it's that, it's a way of going like, you're a member of our team, you know, Quantum Leopard Militia, rah, rah. Yeah. And that's what it is.
Hello, listener. How are you feeling? You enjoying the episode? I hope so. I've been enjoying putting it together. I am just putting this in because you're about to hear a mid-roll ad. Well, you might be. I can't guarantee anything. The ads in the middle are not a given. So basically, the way it works is Acast, who are the podcast hosts who look after this, they go out and find me some advertisers. They'll basically negotiate terms, and then if the advertiser wanted a mid-roll as well as a advert at the start and at the end of the podcast, they pay a little bit extra and have that. I didn't want it to be as random as it kind of came across to me and some other people when I was listening to them back, so I've just put in a little bit of a preamble to the advert. Okay, this is like a pre-roll to the advert. Okay, so you might not be about to get an ad, but if you do, remember I gave you some warning, okay? So here comes your mid-roll ad, or a very weird introduction to absolutely nothing, now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow, isn't that an amazing product and or service? I hope we're all going to buy loads of that. That would be amazing. And even if you don't, it doesn't matter because they've already paid for the advert. So how was the advert any good? Did you even get one? I don't know anymore. I'm talking to you from a different office than the ad people. That was fun. I'm going to get you back to the podcast now, but before I do, come see me on tour or at the Edinburgh Festival at Sweet Venues doing a show called Every Room Becomes a Panic Room When You Overthink Enough. I've already said there's going to be an advert in the middle here, so I might as well chuck in a plug for my shit. There's links in the show notes. Come see me live. I could really appreciate the money. Either that or become a patron and you'll get a copy of this, which has no ads. What? That's revolutionary shit. If you would like a copy of this episode with absolutely no ads and you can listen to it on the podcast player of your choice, become a patron from $1 an episode and you, yes you, my good friend, look me in the face, don't look away, look me in the eye. You could be listening to this episode and not me ramble right now. You'd be listening to it ad-free for the low, low price of 80p. Either way, we're getting back into it now. Bye. Which is very much something I haven't really seen. I mean, other clubs sell T-shirts and things like that. Yeah. So it's sort of your version of that.
Yeah, except yeah. People get the badges for free. They can't be bought with money. They can only be bought with loyalty, which I value much more highly.
Or six friends.
Yeah. Well, it's loyalty by proxy, isn't it? It's like multi-level marketing. But, I mean, the other thing as well is that, just from a sort of a raw mechanics operational point of view, like, these badges cost a couple of quid, and, like, you give the same size of badge to somebody who's an XXS as you do to somebody who's an XXL. You don't need to get a range of them in. You don't need to always be cutting them around. The badges are a hell of a lot lighter than lugging around a load of t-shirts. Yep. So do it that way.
It's why I do badges after all my Edinburgh shows.
Yeah,
like that have like jokes on them from the show, because I'm like, I can carry a bag of badges.
Yeah,
I can't carry freaking, you know, whatever.
Hell of a lot lighter. So that's what we want to be doing. Yeah.
So I mean, they don't make a profit, but they are fucking easier to give away, and people remember them. People come back to my shows and wear them, and I love that.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I get loads of people going like, when can I have a badge? And I'm like, you need to come to two more gigs to come for a badge. Or like, bring six people next time.
Yeah.
Like, sorry.
Yeah, jump the queue.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's like, you know, it does provide a little bit of an incentive, and it's like, it's a nice, like, I mean, it's a playful thing, but like, you know, it's a bit of extra fun. It's a thing that people can get, and it's nice. They're nice badges. I like the badges. Shout out to Billy Stone, who's also a very talented comedian on his own bat, who designed both Quantum Leopard logos. He's done a very, very good job, and people really like him. So cool. For all your graphic design needs,
I will link him in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
Second thing.
Yeah.
As most regular listeners of this podcast will know, I'm a big fan of a mailing list, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you my main reason.
Yeah.
Is I think social media has become so toxic.
Social media,
based around the numbers of everything.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that I know my number, you don't know my number, but they come anyway.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter about the number, so who cares? Why do you have a mailing list? I assume other than that reason.
Yeah, social media promotion is just like pushing on string. Like, way back when, we used to do most of the promo via Facebook, and it was a
ads
mix. Invites. Like, I'd made sure that if I'd made a contact with somebody who was interested in coming to see me at some point in a gig, I would add them on Facebook, and that was my main thing. And that, once upon a time, that was helpful because you could add any number of people to an event and invite them, and it would pop up and it would be like a notification. You would get that, and that would be useful. That's gradually been phased out and become less and less useful. I don't even bother with Facebook events for Quantum Leopard anymore. The Facebook group only exists as a vector for collecting people's email addresses if they want to sign up to the mailing list. So in terms of the mailing list, you're saying, you can monitor how many people are on it, you know how many people you've got, and you can monitor, I'm using MailChimp, you can monitor how many people are opening it, and you
MailChimp.
Can segment
Shout
it.
Shout out to MailChimp.
Yeah, MailChimp. Love it. Link in the doobly-doo. Yeah, MailChimp, dead good. But people actually respond to the emails, and it's also, I've given people an incentive to respond to the emails and open the emails, because now the email is the only way you get tickets. That is literally the only way you get tickets. Or be married to me, that is the only other way of getting tickets.
I've tried, mate. I know. I've proposed several times.
I know, but like, I do not cross my wife. She's from a dangerous and barbaric frontier people, and she will gut you like a snake.
Yeah, but you have no idea how much I like your night.
You have no idea how violently jealous my wife is. So,
well, that sounds worrying.
What happens
and
when exactly? It's what happens when a deeply ignorant object meets a deeply ignorant force.
Okay, lovely. Let's
move on. So mailing list, it's for that reason. People pay attention to them. I've given them an incentive to open the email, and it's not like pushing on the string.
So your events are done. Is it Eventbrite?
No, Ticketek. We use Eventbrite for ages, but
because you're with Two North Down.
With Two North Down. Yeah. Oh, one other thing I will say about the emails. Yeah. The way we collected email addresses, we gave people more of an incentive. Rather than just sign up to the mailing list, part of we give people voting slips when they're picking which of the 5-minute acts they want to see, they want to win, and they want to see do a 10-minute spot at a future one. And it says on there, give me your email address if you want to be on the mailing list. And so we get them like that. It's not like, here's a separate thing, here's a separate sheet of paper, you've got to go to the table at the back and do it. It's, you've got a piece of paper, you've got an opportunity to sign up for the mailing list, and in some ways it's almost harder not to. Nowadays we've got so many regulars, like we get maybe sort of 10, 20, 30 signups per show, something like that, depending how many newbies we've got in. And it sort of gradually builds. I think we've probably got about 900 people on the mailing list, something like that now.
Your night sells out. And I'm only putting it in quotation marks for people who aren't in the room because it's audio. In that it's a free night. So people sign up for it. And so obviously there's a caveat to selling out in that they still have to come down and you know, ideally pay, because then that would obviously keep them that going. So, but obviously you've got a different measure of how you rate a gig's success. So, sort of a logistical question that's kind of boring is...
No, very happy to answer this. And this is kind of, this is the kind of thing that really affects people who are doing shows on this model.
Exactly.
It's really, really important. I want to be very transparent about this. Managing unannounced no-shows is the biggest single obstacle that I face in running this gig. It's really, really important to me for, like, basically, like, ideological reasons. It's a point of principle that I want my gig to be pay what you can, because, like, we live in a vicious society, and I don't want people to be priced out of a good night at the Comedy just because they don't have the money. It's really important to me, and I will put in a significant amount of effort to make sure that that model continues to happen. And it is the thing. It takes up more of my time than booking acts. The only other thing that takes longer than this is vetting applications. And even then, I only do that once every couple of months. So this is something that I have to do for every single gig. Unannounced no-shows are a massive, massive pain.
So if someone booked a ticket and they don't tell you they're not coming and they don't come, banned?
I send them a nice email saying, like, hey, you didn't turn up though you booked tickets. This makes it quite tricky for me to run the gig. Is everything okay? Blah, blah, blah. Sometimes I'll get responses and they'll be like, really good reasons, and that's totally fine. If someone does it a couple of times, I'm just going to remove them from the mailing list. And that's the only way to get tickets, so you won't get to come to the gig. Because it's you by doing that, you are denying somebody else the opportunity to come to the gig. And now I'm at a point where, like, for this one coming up, the next gig, I've got 20 people on my waiting list. I've pushed out a certain number of tickets. I expect a certain number of cancellations before. That's fine. Real life happens. Even with, like, flights, international flights, airlines, where you're paying several hundred pounds for the privilege of flying between countries, they expect a dropout rate of about 5 or 10%, depending on the route. And that's several hundred pounds. That's the investment that people have made in this consumer choice. With a pay what you like comedy night, they've invested no pounds. So I expect a dropout rate of, like, nowadays, if I'm doing well, I will get a 5 to 10% dropout rate on the numbers that I get. I operate on the assumption that I will get slightly more than that, but that's why I operate the waiting list system, and I will reallocate. I book a certain number of tickets. I put out a certain number of tickets, which is slightly more than the official fire safety capacity of the venue. I wouldn't want to fill it to fire safety capacity, because that'd be incredibly uncomfortable for everybody. And I manage that, and it's more art than science, but we've never been at fire safety capacity, and it's been very hot and absolutely rammed and standing room only, and been let's be honest here, a bit uncomfortable from time to time. But, like, we've kept it safe, and we've kept the gig as pay what you like, and that's really, really important to me. So dealing with those sorts of no-shows is really, really difficult. One of the main things that combats it is having, like, this in-group loyalty of having, like, the Quantum Leopard Militia, the badge people. They're absolutely fucking lovely. Like, they're proper sort of comedy super fans who, like, really enjoy their comedy, really lovely, really love the night and love them to bits, and they're the people who keep the night going. I 100% do it for them. But having them as being, like, the main people that book tickets means that I have a far lower dropout rate. And that's another good reason, for selfish reasons, why putting tickets out to them early is a good thing and is helpful. Provides them a benefit, they definitely get a ticket. Provides me a benefit, I've got people who are much less likely to drop out.
Well, there's a few people questioning this, and it's I think it's of interest more for Edinburgh, but I think let's talk about it in terms of your night as a sort of monthly.
Yeah.
So obviously London's a very expensive city. I assume and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and even if not, we can talk about that if you can. You pay a higher fee for the venue.
Yeah.
You have door staff, lovely, lovely door staff.
Yeah.
You have people who...
I'm going to say hello to some combination of Reese, Sarah and Alison. Thanks, Reese, Sarah and Alison. Thank
you. I was going to do a shout-out, but I find it's fine. Yeah, well, they're more yours than mine, but they're always absolutely lovely, yeah. You know, every time I chat to them. So.
They're all former punters. They're all people who came along tonight, loved it so much, and stayed, and have stayed for long enough, and now they help me out doing front of house, and I pay them.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So you have staff, essentially.
Yeah.
You have a profitable night. But how do you budget without knowing... I mean, obviously, after a certain amount of months, you're like, well, this person usually gives this amount. But something might change.
Yeah.
You know, they might... So anxiety-wise, for a person wanting to start a night like this...
Yeah.
Who wants to pay acts...
Yeah, yeah.
Who doesn't want to have to take, you know, £200 out of their pocket to pay all the acts.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what you pay acts for the time they're doing.
Yeah.
Approximates, if you want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And because I'm having a flexible for certain things. And how you mediate... not necessarily knowing how much you're going to be able to get how much you have to pay for stuff.
So it was different once upon a time when we started and to how it is now, because obviously there's far more people, there's more money sloshing around, all of this sort of stuff.
We can talk about both if you...
That's fine. I think it's important to kind of separate those out as two things. The first thing I do want to say here, and I think this is really important, that this is not a night that I run for money. Like, I make some money on it, but like, genuinely, if money was my objective here, it would make more sense for me to just work some overtime. Like, the amount of time that I put into running this gig, like, I don't even make like minimum wage running it with the cut that I take once all of the expenses have been taken out. When I started, I just did it as bucket split, and I paid my feature acts, so headliner and opener and middle tens, I paid all of them, and that was just done as straight bucket split, and people were aware that that was what the deal was, with an obvious tilt towards trying to pay the headliner more because they are a professional, generally speaking. Like, I'm not sure we've professional or should be treated as professional because they are of that standard and paid accordingly, blah blah. I've gradually over the years been able to pay headliners and feature acts more and more. I've gradually phased in paying the 5 minute acts, and so they're paid like it's only a fiver, but it's the principle of the thing is that I can pay everybody, so I'm going to pay everybody. Like, I'm not aware of anywhere else, I will be proved wrong, I'm not aware of anywhere else that pays acts for 5 minutes.
I'm not either, so that's we might get some expenses here and there for club nights, but yeah, it's the same sort of thing.
So what I generally do, and what I did in kind of like the intermediate kind of stage was, and I'm still basically doing this now, is if an act is not somebody that I've dealt with before, like basically acts you've dealt with me before, like generally know and like and trust me to give them a fair share of the bucket. Good bucket, you'll get a good share of the take, blah, blah, blah. And they trust me to do that. If an act doesn't know me or I'm going through an agent or something like that, I will generally like guarantee them a minimum and say, look, it's likely to be like, I will guarantee you this much and I will pay you more if the bucket is good. And it generally is good. So I do generally get to pay people more. So that's roughly the model of how we do it. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. You won an award.
Oh yeah, we did.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah. How does that, because I mean, it's kind of a two-part question, but I think the answer from you would be in the same thing. You're quite an underground club.
I'm just bad at marketing, Simon. That's most of it is.
Oh, right, yeah. You're quite bad at marketing, James.
I would say. Thing.
I would say more. You have a cultish following for the night.
Yeah.
And you
cult personality. I'm a charismatic socialist with a moustache and cult following. When has that ever gone wrong?
That's well. I mean. Corbett? No, let's not
talk
about
that. Let's go with the beard. Anyway.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, right. He had a moustache at some point, but anyway.
He did. Anyway, right. Yeah. I want Corbyn as Prime Minister, much less than I want John McDonnell as Chancellor. That's really, really
important. Don't want any of them but let's not talk about that right now.
All right.
I don't want any...
Drop mic, walk out. Right.
Yeah.
Right, so...
So, you've got a bit of a culty night.
Yeah, yeah.
It's underground.
That won
an award that, let's be frank about this,
yeah,
other clubs wanted.
Yeah.
More than you.
Can't have it. We got it.
No, for this year. But my point is that the Comedy Store, the Piccadilly Comedy Club, Soho, the list goes on because it's a London-based award for...
It's the Chortle Award for Best Comedy Night in London 2018.
Yeah.
So the key thing there
is this year, jury's out.
Yeah, jury's out. it's taken a real nosedive in quality in 2019. I've really started half-assing it.
I've just got massively complacent.
Yeah, got Kane in. Just got like 2.5 hours with no intervals just with Simon Kane.
I'm doing that for Edinburgh this year, to be fair. It's a preview.
Such a mistake. Such a mistake. Yeah. So just to clarify, yeah. it's a single individual night. We're not competing against, like... If we
but it is something they would want.
Yeah, yeah, because it's an award and it comes from Chortle and therefore has prestige and like they would want that and that's fine. Yeah. But like, you know, our direct competition for that would be like specific nights that they would run. Wouldn't be like for the Comedy Store as a whole. No. Or Angel
It'd be
Comedy
like for Sunday Players or something like that.
Something I had not heard of that, but probably. That thing. If they've got...
Oh, the The Gong or something like that. Yeah.
Something's got... A cohesive identity of its own. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, they would want it. And like, lucky us, we got it. And but like, you know, the way that I'm going to be very transparent about this, the way the nomination system works is that like it's by audience vote. Like you email in to vote. So, you know.
You just ask your cult.
Like I said, here's the thing. The Chortle Award, you know, we think we're doing good things with comedy. It'd be nice if you voted for us. I didn't push it very hard. I think I maybe put it in one mailer and maybe did like maybe two Facebook posts. If that constitutes campaigning, then that's campaigning.
But I mean, I'd say it's more campaigning than just ignoring it, but yeah.
It is more campaigning than just ignoring it. Yeah. Like, let's be fair. And like, you know, again,
but you're bad at marketing, so it's fine.
I'm not without vanity. Like, you know, it's nice to win an award. Like I've won two awards in my comedy career. One of them is for running this night, for running Quantum Leopard, which I put a hell of a lot of work into. I'm really, really proud of building up. I think I've built like a lovely night that's fun for acts, fun for punters, and has got a real kind of community spirit to it. My only other award, there's an improv group that I set up and ran from scratch called Fat Kitten Improv, and we won the Make-A-Wish Theatre Sports Cup, which is the only thing in UK improv at the time for which there was an award. So my two comedy awards are basically for admin, and I have no shame in that because admin is really fucking hard. Being a decent comedian, I hate you, because I do tons of admin.
Yeah, and I get
and no awards.
I didn't know
no
there was any awards. No,
yeah.
No. But people tell me I'm great at it.
Yeah, like it's a skill. Like stuff doesn't just happen. Like it's so easy to take this sort of stuff for granted. When I hear people bitching about like the Free Fringe, I'm like, you have no idea how much work goes into this. Mm. Like these are people who are saving you several thousands pounds by providing or trying to provide you with like with a venue at Edinburgh time, and like all of the whining that goes on. Like if you don't like it, pay several thousand pounds for the alternative. You know, it's a cooperative and you get as much out of it as you put in, all of this sort of stuff. Like these are people who are working their asses off, unpaid, largely underappreciated, because it's something that they believe in. Like without people doing this sort of community spirited thing, not just in comedy, in any aspect of society, like the things that make life worth living, the thing that makes society worth living in, don't happen. Like, you know, my mum and dad are scout leaders and guide leaders and have been for like about 40 odd years, something like that, like way longer than I've been alive. And like, they don't do that for the money. They do that because they think it's important to give something back to the community and like to give young people opportunities to do things that are maybe outside their experience, maybe like take some risks in a safe control, like a comparatively controlled environment, controlled risk. That's how you grow as a person. But without those opportunities, without them volunteering huge amounts of their time, and I've seen how much time they put into it behind the scenes, like this doesn't happen. Like, and society becomes like weaker and more boring as a result, and you just have things that you pay for, you have, and that becomes the only reason why stuff happens, is because you can make a profit out of it. Like the things that make life worth living and make society worth living in are the stuff that people do, the things that people do because it doesn't make a profit, because they think it would be a good idea, it would be nice to do this. If you put a price on absolutely everything, then it cheapens it because you've assigned a value to it, and it's an arbitrary value, and you've assigned a price to it, and that has undercut its value. By applying a price, you've destroyed the value.
Especially with art.
Yeah. But like, if you want to make this like a sort of a fancy, wafty nonsense conversation, I think that applies to so many other things in life. Like,
it does, but
if you pay somebody to love you, then that love has no value. You've put a price on it, and you've destroyed the voluntary impulse that makes that a thing that is worth having, for want of a better verb. Yeah, and I think that's so true of anything else that's like a voluntary endeavour, voluntary enterprise, whether that is supporting a community by running a scout or guide group for 40 odd years, whether that's running a comedy night, that is giving something back. I could make so much more money off Quantum Leopard if I wanted to. I just don't want to. I want to run something that is like good and nice.
Well, okay, Let me just ask you this question before we move on to Edinburgh. How could you make money from Quantum Leopard if you wanted to?
Oh, God. You've got me a spot there. I've taught myself into a rhetorical corner, and now I need to back up. How could I do that?
As a genuine question, because I think it's... and we won't talk about your work, but I think it's fair to say that you have a job.
I have a day job, and I have a day job that pays the bills. Yeah. And like it's a, so you're in a middling corporate job. I am comfortable. I don't need to run...
So you're in a position where... quite a privileged position where you can run a night and not necessarily worry about if it did make a loss, you would be fine. I'm just making that clear because there are people out there who potentially are unemployed who want to start a night who are going, oh, I can do this and it's going to, you know, I just want to make it clear you're so.
Absolutely. And so I generally don't make a loss on Quantum Leopard. There have been gigs where I have made a loss, in some cases quite a substantial loss on particularly tricky nights that have been difficult for whatever reason. But generally speaking, I do make some money from it. Like I say, in terms of the amount of time I put in, it's not even minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's I don't like lose money. Like
you get a nice gig out of it,
Exactly. I get a nice gig out. Like by the standards of most people's hobbies, it's extremely lucrative. By the standards of most people's professions, it's incredibly poorly paid and indeed illegal. So blah blah. How could I make more money out of it?
Put my corporate hat on.
How could I make? I don't know. I mean, this is the thing. Like, buying. How could I? Let me have a think. I mean, you know, I've said that. I'm not sure that I could. I think now that I've maybe developed a USP in such a way that by pushing it more in that direction, I probably couldn't. Well, one of the things I might do is put like a fixed ticket price on it, and that way, and like not refund people for not showing up. I probably could do that. That's the only thing I could think that I could maybe do that would involve some sort of moral compromise that. I mean, I would consider that a massive moral compromise, and that would be like right at the bottom of my list. I would really consider whether I wanted to run the gig at all if that was the price that I had to pay to do it, morally speaking, not financially. But that's a thing that I could like maybe justify to regulars who thought that things like the ethos was like that. I think of the ethos and pay what you like as being like comparably important. Mm-hmm. They're both vital pillars that support what the night is. But for maybe regulars who thought that the ethos was more important than pay what you like, maybe I could do that and maybe run like that. Maybe that's a thing that I could do. But that's the only thing that I can really think of. I think if I were to try and make it like full corporate, then I would put so many people off and that would destroy what it was as a night and people would stop coming.
So is it scalable?
It's as big as I want it to be. Like, I mean, I may want to run it slightly more often because I bloody love booking the thing, genuinely, because it's like, okay, I really like you as an act and I want to watch you perform. I really like you as an act, I want to watch you perform. Every single bill is packed with acts that I want to see. This is the sort of the customised Netflix queue of comedy for me, and I blooming love it. The only times when I'll take a bit more of a risk is with the 5-minute spots, but they're 5-minute spots, and if I don't like them, they're over in a few minutes, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And I really like booking it, so I'd maybe want to push it to maybe once a fortnight. I think I tried that once, and we struggled for numbers a bit. Once every 3 weeks means it's an occasion. People put it in the diaries and they definitely come.
That's what I like about running a monthly.
Yeah.
Is I feel like the people that come every month will come every couple of months.
Exactly.
It's like we book it every quarter or every 6 months and they sort of go, I like the theme of the February one, or I like that. And so they come. Yeah. So I think that's another tip for people who want to run a night. You know, don't. There are open mics that run every week, and there are good nights that run every, like yours that run every week as well.
Well, we're every three weeks.
No, but I'm saying there are nights. Other nights that run every week that are great. But by having it as a rarity, you up the value of their reason for going. Yeah.
Make it an occasion, make it an experience. If you're setting up a night, start off running it monthly. Run it monthly. Maybe like run one test thing as a launch night, as a bit of a sort of blah, 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 get your mates in for that.
Mm.
If you can prove to them that you can run a decent night, then they are much more likely to come back to something if you do it as a monthly thing. Mm. Monthly is like, that's very limited social pressure. If you miss one, there'll be another one in a month's time, blah, blah, blah. But people who are coming to every single one of them because it's amazing and I believe in you, it's going to be amazing. Like, don't feel that you're going to see you as the only thing they do for fun. You know what I mean? So I think I know maybe at most I'd want to push it to once a fortnight. Maybe like we could fill more seats, like we could fill a bigger venue, but I mean 2 North Downs has got like lovely capacity. I'm comfortable with that. I don't really want it to be that much bigger.
What's the capacity?
The official fire safety capacity I think is about 100 people. You need to ask the venue staff whether that includes cast and crew or not. I don't think it does. but that's kind of roughly what you're looking at. Like, I mean, I suppose in an ideal world, I'd have somewhere that has like the wonderful atmosphere and staff of 2 North Down, but I'd have another 20 or 30 seats in, and that would enable me, I could scale it up a bit, I could get more money in the bucket, which would mean I could pay acts more, and that'd be good. I'd like to be able to pay people more for their time, because I think I pay people decently. I think we compare quite favourably on rates to many London clubs, but not maybe weekend tent pole kind of things, you know what I mean? Like, pros can do our gig and headline, and that's okay for them, but it's not a big earning gig. It's a gig where it's like, I'm doing this gig because I love the gig, I'm gonna have a really great time. If I can double up on the night, I'm definitely going to, kind of thing. But like, the money, if they don't manage to double up, then it's not a waste of a night, they've not made a loss on the evening.
It ends kind of on time and early enough that you could headline a late night or a late show.
You could certainly open, you can open anywhere else in London and do our gig.
This is the first time you've had a venue that isn't a rehearsal space, essentially. How did you pick there?
We really struggled. I was trying to find somewhere else. So previously it was both pay what you like and bring your own booze. So that was a real USP for us. Like super cheaps. So you could genuinely, you could come to our night with like no money and like a six pack that you got from the supermarket, have a fucking amazing night, be off your face, have a great night at the Comedy. Brilliant. The thing, what I had to jettison, because we were really struggling to find spaces that fit our other criteria, was the BYOB thing. Like, we couldn't make that work anywhere else. And I made so many inquiries. I tried so hard to find a space that was like that, but we just couldn't. All of the rehearsal spaces I'm dealing with were losing their spaces to developers, which is like, you know, the dead hand of capitalism just like slaps itself across any fun that's had in London. The only other places where we could potentially have done that were like too far out. They were like a tricky bit of zone 2, or they were zone 3, and like that would mean that it would be really hard for people to get to, it wouldn't necessarily be safe for people to get back, things like that, and those are considerations. So we had to drop that bit. So it was like, okay, where do we know that's in zone 1 that is affordable given our budget, that is nice, that gets what we're trying to do, that will give us a space for an evening. And 2 North Down, like, they're on the up, they've kind of just developed the space, they've been going for a little while but not ages and ages, so we're not like displacing anybody, we're not stepping on anybody's toes in a way that we might be even with like, you know, fun indie people like Angel. Like, they're really heavily booked and they've got loads of stuff going on, and we would be less special as a pay what you like night at Angel. As a pay what you like night at 2 North Down, we've got more of a USP, we've got more of an atmosphere, and like we're more of a cult favourite at somewhere like 2 North Down. We're a tentpole night for them in a way that we wouldn't necessarily be at a more established comedy club. And I said the greatest respect to 2 North Down, because it's going to become super established, because it's a lovely space that's really well done, that's booked by people who really fucking know what they're doing. Yeah, really, really great people. Shout out to Alana, Sam and the team.
Okay, Edinburgh.
Yeah, Edinburgh.
You go with PBH?
Yeah.
Or when you go with PBS.
Yeah, yeah. Haven't for a number of years because reasons of baby. I've got a 2-year-old, and an Edinburgh run is utterly incompatible with a child, or at least preparing a show to the standard you were wanted to is incompatible with having a child and a job.
And if you were doing that pre this night?
Yes.
So it feels, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like that precursor set you up for a lot of the...
Absolutely, 100%, 100%. Right. Like, in many ways, Peter Buckley Hill is the grandfather of Quantum Leopard, like, ideologically speaking.
As I'm out to do a spot whenever... No, no. I wanted to talk to you about your mentality about the Fringe, why you do it, whether... what was your reasoning for doing that?
So I did, when I was doing... So I've done 6 Edinburgh Fringe runs running my own shows, 3 of them with improv shows where I run my group, Fat Kitten, and 3 with solo stand-up. Or in the first case, it was a two-hander. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so the reasons for doing it are because, like, it's an amazing time. Like, if comedy is the thing that you do for fun, you will get to do more of it in a month than you could anywhere else under any other circumstances. If you've got a show that you think is quite good at the beginning, it is the best place to go to practice that and get really, really, really slick at it 20 odd times over the course of a month. The atmosphere is amazing, and, you know, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll learn something about the human condition. Like, it's comedy boot camp. Like, I feel that, like, you know, it's got corporate, it's got commercial, you can still have a good experience doing a free fringe show. And I think that's a really important thing to say. It is a very different experience. And I would recommend that if you've got no stroke limited money, is that you don't just like piss money into the darkness on PR. Go up there, do it yourself, make mistakes, fail. If you're losing money, at least you know that you'll be losing money on things that are reasonable essentials. You won't be spending a couple of grand on PR. You won't be spending a couple of grand on venue hire. Your biggest single expense will be accommodation. And after that, food. After that, transport. After that, transport flyer is probably about the same sort of thing. Like, go up there, flyer it yourself, shoulder to the wheel, take care of yourself, certainly in weeks one and two, and then just fuck it. Drink like a fish in week three. How wrong can it go? Go up and have an amazing time. I do it because it's an amazing experience. It's where you go from being like, you should never go while you're bad, but it's where you go in order to like really hone your craft, to go from being a 6 out of 10 comedian to being an 8 or a 9 out of 10 comedian. Like,
yeah,
that's what you want. It's that really intense experience.
Yeah. And I would rather drink the final week when all the nominations are out and you didn't get one. That feels more healthy to me.
Don't go out having expecting a nomination. Go up there expecting failure, but knowing that you're gonna like do your best to put on like an amazing show. You like, it's so easy to forget this as a performer. Like, just because you enjoy performing and that's why you do it, that's not why comedy exists. Like, comedy exists because you're there to entertain people. Like, you are there. Like, it's an enormous privilege to have an audience's attention. Like, attention is brilliant, right? It's great. It's loads of fun. Just ask my toddler. Fucking loves it. Like, he's so much his father's son in that respect. Attention is brilliant. It is an enormous privilege. But you are there to, you need to make good use of that attention. You can't waste it. You can't treat your audience badly. Like, you are there to entertain them. That's why they've come to see you. They've not come to stroke your ego. You need to go there and put on like the best show that you possibly can that's going to entertain people as best as you are able. Go out there and like find pleasure in making people happy. Like, that's why you should go out to Edinburgh, and that's why you should be doing comedy. And if you are doing it because you want, you know, fame, riches, the good, stable, happy life, then you're doing it for the wrong reasons, and you're going to be enormously, enormously disappointed.
Would it also be fair to say, because we've discussed this off mic, and you might not want to discuss it now, you're, due to personal stuff and family stuff, your expectations and aims for what you're going to get out of comedy have adjusted
hugely. I've mentioned this, I've used this phrase before, but it bears repeating again because it applies to these circumstances. I made a very deliberate decision a few years ago, like I was a couple of years into stand-up, I made a very deliberate decision that I was going to make comedy a very well-paid hobby that I enjoy rather than a very poorly paid job I resent, because I wanted a family, I wanted children, I wanted to be a father. That was really important to me, and that I know that there are comedians who make it work, but they, like, it's not without its stresses. That is not something that I could plausibly do. I have a bit of material security because I've committed some of my resources, like intellectual, to having a day job that is like reasonably well paid and that I can provide like security and stability for a family with. That is not something that you can do with comedy. Like, you will almost certainly be renting forever, all of this sort of stuff, unless you've got a side gig at minimum.
And particularly not when you're running Pay What You Want nights and Edinburgh Fringes, that you don't know how much money you're going to be
getting. Like that's the sort of gamble that you can't make with somebody else's money. And if you've got kids, you are making that gamble with money that you are using to feed them. So that's not a risk that you can take if you're doing that. Like, I mean, well, you can, but you're a terrible parent. Don't do it. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah, and it makes sense why you haven't been to Edinburgh for a couple of years as well since that. So it's quite cool. And then really quickly, the tour you did.
Oh, the Front Room Tour.
I was at your show, I think it was 2016 or 2015.
Yeah, something
where,
like that.
Where you, at the end, were trying to sell tea towels of your face.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, by the way, great merchandising. Lighter than t-shirts, but not as light as badges.
And like, you only need one size of tea towel.
Oh, yeah.
This is the vital thing. When you're lugging them up and down the country.
Remember that, everyone. The one size fits all merchandise is the best. So you've got your tea towels.
Yeah.
And then you were like, if you want to come and see this show again, but in your living room.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you'd done maybe living room previews then, and you were like, let's carry on with this. I mean,
in my own house. I was like, well, give us a go. How wrong can it go? And then I did a few.
Turns out quite a lot.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm under no illusions there. Like, it's something that I could only do because, like, you know, I do not fear sleeping in strangers' houses, and I'm aware that's something that I could do because I'm a bloke, and a bloke with the ability and, like, you know, social comments, blah, 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 to say, like, no, fuck off, get out of this bed, all of this sort of stuff. Like, that's the kind of thing that I can do. And equally, like, if my accommodation falls through, then I'm like, it's not as dangerous or uncomfortable or awkward for me to like camp out for the night literally like on a station concourse or whatever. Like, that's a thing that I can do. So the main reason for doing that was like, I'm not a club comic. In order to tour my show and get in front of more people and get more gigs, I would need to do more club gigs. Like, they're not really for me. Like, some of them are really good and really fun, and if that's your thing, like, go for it. You do you. No judgment. I'm doing my thing. It's not really for club gigs, and vice versa. That's fine. Otherwise, so it was my way of, like, finding my audience and doing something special for them and, like, doing gigs to, like, a pre-built audience. It was doing something for people that were coming to see me. It's like, let's have this really cool, amazing thing. We're going to have a house party, and the thing that we're going to do that's going to make this house party special is, yeah, we're just going to have this comedian come in, and he's just going to do his hour in my lounge with no microphone. And I saw the show in Edinburgh. It was really great. You're going to fucking love this, blah, 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 all of this. Like, you know, I had maybe one ropey gig with doing those, and that was right at the end, because I was, you know, my wife was heavily pregnant at the time, and I was really stressed out, and I hadn't done it for a couple of months, and it was a bit of a whimper to the end.
I think, but those are all reasonable reasons.
Yeah. But, like, I had so many amazing gigs there that were so much fun to do. And it's one of these things, though, like, it's a really, really informal atmosphere, and it's a proper... Like, 20 years ago, I would have tried to do, like, a tour of, like, squats or whatever. That infrastructure just doesn't exist anymore. But this was kind of, like, the next best thing. And I was doing, like, you know, student houses and, like, you know, various other kind of, like, shared accommodation bits and pieces. Like, I did almost no gigs and somebody's like, I own my own home. Come do it in my conservatory. Very few of them. It was always people who were, like, committed to doing the sort of DIY ethos kind of thing, who kind of got what I was doing, who liked the show, partly for those sorts of reasons. I kind of really wanted to get on board with it for that reason. So it was finding my core audience, building my crowd. It was kind of inspired by the whole, like, Amanda Palmer thing, who did a very, very similar sort of thing. Just nick that idea, do that in my format. If it works for Amanda Palmer, fucking work for me. I pay my tour support. I didn't have tour support. Actually, no, I did. I had tour support on two occasions, but that was it. But mostly I just did my own thing.
Yeah, and I'm guessing there's a vetting... I mean, like, what would the... Say someone wants to do a living room tour,
yeah,
a comedy living room tour, because obviously it's different from music. What were the biggest things you learned, and what were the biggest mistakes you made?
Yeah,
and probably what were the things you learned from the mistakes.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like, vetting wasn't that much of an issue. Like, usually if somebody is, like, together enough to actually organise the gig and...
So you, like, you had a minimum criteria, like, you've got to bring 10 friends or
something like that. Like, I was very clear with them of, like, this is going to get, like, awkward if you don't have like the minimum number of people that you need in a room is probably about 10-12. So, like, you've got to be very, very clear and say, look, this is the absolute minimum for it to not be awkward and weird. So be super, super clear about that. Make sure that you check at every stage that, okay, so you're going to be hosting this gig. Is this time okay for me to turn up? Is this the right station? Is it definitely actually happening? Am I okay to stay over? Do you have a bed for me, or do I need to bring a sleeping bag? Like, these sorts of things, like, check this sort of stuff, have a checklist. If you want to make money from it, I was doing it as pay what you like, which I think is the only way that you can do it with this sort of thing. Like, rattle a bucket at the end. And what I did with my free fringe shows and what I did with this tour as well was basically say, you know, if you give me a tenner, you get a DVD of my previous year's show and a tea towel with my terrifying face on it. So it's like, it's an item that's both fun and lightweight. Mm-hmm. And it's also, like, it's something that tells a story. Somebody has, like, a tea towel that's got my printed screaming fisheye lens taken photograph over it. Like, that's something that you can, like, terrify people with. And I keep being sent photos still of people who've taken these tea towels, like, terrifying parts of the world. One lady came to see the show. She'd sewn it into her pillowcase and presented it to her boyfriend over the bed as a prelude to an evening of sensuous delight. Fucking love that shit. Send me photos of that. That's great. Not the prelude, not the sensual delight. I'm fine with that.
Oh, shame. I had a great tweet ready for you.
Those are kind of my key points. It's like, check everything. Remember that you're there to have a good time. Also, I would recommend that you only do this when you are quite well established and confident in A, your abilities, and B, your show. It takes a very specific sort of show to be able to do that. It needs to be non-theatrical. You need to be happy to break the fourth wall. Like, my show ran pretty tightly to an hour in Edinburgh, like an Edinburgh hour 55. Mm. Whenever I was doing it in people's front rooms, it was an hour and a half. It was 2 hours. I had to incorporate an interval. Mm. All of this sort of, because I got chatting, I riffed more, I was back and forthing more with the audience, all of this sort of stuff. People have had drinks. It's a very different environment to doing it in a club setting or even an Edinburgh show setting. And you need to be, like, very aware of that when you're doing it. So those would be my main pointers. Also, you will always get one person in a house party type setting like this, and it's always a white bloke who thinks that they're funny and they need to stick their oar in. Like, it's the classic, it's exactly the type of mentality that you get with a heckler. It's trickier to slap this person down because they're somebody's mate. But at the same time, it's like, you do that with a smile. That learning how to deal with that person, and there's one at every gig, is really, really important. So, okay. Yeah, go with that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Last question.
Yeah.
Who, to you, is the most underrated person in the comedy industry?
Most underrated person in the comedy industry? Look, I'm just going to say, and this is going to be a controversial choice, blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to say PBH. Like, he's retired.
As in Peter Buckley Hill?
As in Peter Buckley Hill, okay. Yeah. I mean, both as him as an individual and as an organisation. Because, like, without him, can you fucking imagine what the Free Fringe would what the Edinburgh Fringe would be like now? Like, it would go the way of all, you know, the natural tendency of all markets under capitalism is towards monopoly, at minimum, oligopoly. Performers charged through the nose. The free model has presented an alternative to that. You know, I would be the first to say that he is not the easiest person to get on with, but he has contributed so much. He has sweated so much into this. Like, I've read his book and it is very interesting. I perhaps do not share his historical interpretation of some of the events that are described within it. I've been on the ground, blah, blah, blah. But, like, it is undeniable that he has contributed an enormous amount to comedy and the welfare of comedians and the amount of stick that he's got for that. Granted, some of his behaviour that is, you know, and the way he expresses himself is not too touchy-feely. He's given so much and hasn't got, I think, a fraction of the respect that he deserves for that. People who do comedy at every level, punters of comedy, like, it takes so much to organise this stuff and to organise it well and make things happen. And that's what people ignore. So, like, there are loads of great acts out there. Every single one of my Quantum Leopard competition winners is somebody that I would recommend as an act. And I think they're all the most underrated acts in comedy because, like, they're going to be winning the awards, blah, blah, blah. They're the voice of tomorrow as selected by my audience. They're all great. They're all amazing. They're going to be fantastic performers. They are fantastic performers. They're going to be like the proper stars of tomorrow. But in terms of the back end of it, PBH, PBH.
Cool. And thank you very much for taking part.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
That was James. Oh my God. I loved hearing about his DIY attitude and mentality and also how he's not lost himself within the industry. I think so many people can get so wrapped up. I think it's just a freelance mentality, really. If you are freelance, you have to work paycheck to paycheck. You have to take a lot of work that you don't necessarily like doing. And obviously, because he has a day job, he's able to really keep hold of his morals, keep a hold of his values, keep a hold of his own ethics and run a comedy night that really encompasses that. And it was great. In addition to that, hearing his struggles with his work-life comedy balance and the pros and cons of running a night the way he decided to do it was really exciting. I think everyone who's ever run a comedy night or has even put on a one-off show knows that there are compromises that get made along the way, and you can't always have everything you where you want it. So I think for definite, that is a lot of learning in there and a big learning curve for everyone. And I think if you're listening to this and you're in comedy or you're a comedy fan and you're a bit annoyed with how a club treats you or how the running orders are put together or anything like that, put on a show. Just see what it's like from the other side. It's really, really interesting to switch sides and learn a bit more from someone else's perspective. And this really offered me a lot of that. So that was really good. If you like this episode, you might also like other episodes with Angel Comedy Club, where I interviewed Barry Ferns and Sarah Pierce about how they crowdfunded a comedy empire, really, but starting with a club above a pub in Angel, and now they own their own pub. So there's that, and also you can listen to Monkey Barrel Comedy Club with Ben Verth and John Miller, and how they started a comedy club in Edinburgh, and how that has grown and continues to grow into what is one of the most pivotal and interesting comedy clubs in the country. I highly recommend both those episodes. I mean, I'm biased, but I highly recommend them both. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate your time. I'm currently bouncing around on tour. I'm on a preview tour of this new show called Every Room Becomes a Panic Room When You Overthink Enough. I'm taking it to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival at Sweet Venues in the Grass Market. There's a link in the show notes if you want to get a ticket to that or any of the previews that I'm going to be doing up and down the country. So please, please, please come to that. I would really appreciate it. If you can't support me that way because I'm nowhere near you or because you just don't want to come, that's absolutely fine. If you're new here, hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do give us a donation to keep this going. You can do it either as a one-off via PayPal on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk, or you can do it as a patron from $1 an episode. Was this worth a dollar? I think it was worth a dollar. It must be worth $1 or 80p. Why not? Took me 7-8 hours to put together. It must be worth at least 80p of my time. That's pretty much child labour level payments, isn't it?
If you thought this was worth anything, I would massively appreciate a donation and you keep the project going. So thank you very much for that, for the people that do. The RC Industry Podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye.
As the day winds down, don't let allergies disrupt your night. At Aspire Allergy and Sinus, we're here to bring you peace and relief. Our expert team offers personalized allergy testing and advanced treatments, so you can enjoy restful nights free from the struggles of congestion and discomfort. Make the evenings yours again. Visit AspireAllergy.com to schedule an appointment and experience a life where every breath is serene. Breathe easy. Sleep better. Aspire Allergy, your pathway to peaceful nights and brighter mornings. AspireAllergy.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.